I find it fascinating to see the wide range of papers that we've had from large systems and farmer participatory research on all subjects. The warning that we had with the first paper, not to think everything is a nail just because you have a hammer in your hand. And so keeping that in mind, I'm going to be focusing on the soil limitations, recognizing that there are all sorts of genetic and other agronomic and economic and social limitations going on at the same time. I want to talk a little bit about how to diagnose what particular problems on a site-specific basis are causing limitations in farmer fields. And there's kind of four components that I think need to be covered. There's, of course, the farmer, and we've heard a lot about that from the last couple of papers. And then there's the landscape in the field, which needs to be assessed in terms of the variability and the situation there. And then we can take a look at the soil and also at the plants. These are all integrated together. I won't focus very much on getting information from the farmer, except that I want to borrow a phrase from a former U.S. president. I think it was Reagan, with regard to nuclear arms deals with the Russian, that said, trust but verify. And I think that's the attitude I usually take with farmers. What they say is not always what you find in the field, so it's a good idea to also verify. What I've become fascinated with over the past few years, when I've had the privilege to spend a great deal of time working with the Millennium Villages Project and therefore intimately involved in a number of villages around different countries in Africa, as well as some work I've done in other continents, is this concept of field variability. I feel this is a huge problem, but it's also an opportunity to help with diagnosis. This is just a field in northern Ethiopia, and like most smallholder fields, it has areas that are much better than other areas. And you have to wonder what makes these good spots so good, and that begs the question that I've been raising with some of my colleagues in the field. Suppose we could make the whole field as good as those good spots. This might easily double or triple yields to the farmer. There are all kinds of things that cause this variability. Often it has to do with water. This, again, is in northern Ethiopia, where even a small terrace will collect a lot of water, and that will show up later on in the crop productivity, either where you had extra water or where sometimes there was too much water. But topography isn't only about the flow of water. There are consequences of that in soil development. And we often find variability that's systematic with topography. This is kind of a striking example from southern Malawi. This is irrigated maize in the dry season, and the upper end of the field has quite different soil than the lower end of the field if you bring them together and compare them. It's a little difficult to see this unless you sample on a transect. And in fact, there was a difference in the organic matter and in the pH. Now, what I want to point out is that these differences were discovered in the field. The numbers were obtained on the spot in the field so that we can then discuss with the farmer what could be done about it. Another, what I'm coming to think is a major source of this variability, is inefficient methods of applying amendments, especially organic amendments like manure. This is just an example from just a few weeks ago in Rwanda, when manure is usually carried either by the ox cart load or by the head load and dumped. And so I asked the farmer, well, then what do you do? He said, oh, well, then we spread it evenly and incorporate it. So to verify, I said, well, could you demonstrate that? He went and got his hoe, and he demonstrated on the right side and pretty much incorporated the pile where it was sitting in situ. So I think that kind of confirmed my suspicion that this stuff didn't get spread, and that it might be much easier, rather than dumping that pile, to walk along and spread it in a row before you dump it, so it might get more even. And you see the result of this in farmers' fields all over the world, not only manure spreading, but also gathering crop residues together and burning it in one spot this year and another spot another year. So I think you can see these rather marked variability in that wheat field in northern Ethiopia. So once we get an idea of this variability, we can use it to determine where we might want to look at the soil. If a field has these markedly better spots in it, it means that the climate and the variety and the farmer practice is capable of doing much more than is being done, and often these are related to soil properties. So I usually make an effort to try to sample the soil in various ways, including taking a traditional composite sample of the good areas and of the poor areas, and then running a number of tests, again, with the farmer in the field, so we can kind of go to the next step. We get the answers there, and then we can say, well, okay, if this is a problem, what can we do about it? This includes training farmers and extension agents. In this case, this was at Mayanje in the Millennium Village in Rwanda, to take samples with the tools that are available, in this case a hoe and a machete, to get a sliver of soil so that we have some control over depth and can get a decent composite sample. So what can you actually do in the field? Other than there's a lot you can do just by feeling and looking at the soil and you know, feeling the texture and that type of thing. But if you carry a few simple tools with you, and few and simple is getting a little more complicated as time goes on. I've got a fairly good sized box I carry around now. But you are able to actually get quite a few answers in the field, and this can lead to some really nice problem solving, both in soil chemistry and some physical properties and biological properties. So this is sort of the big box that I'm carrying. It has grown over the last couple of years. It's a decent sized toolbox. It's not too bad. You can carry it for a pretty good distance, and it's jam packed with lots of gadgets and things which I've try to keep robust and cheap if possible. Here's an example of it being used on the ground. Pedro Sanchez is here in the audience, and we did some of these things recently on a little trip, and you get an idea. There's a big difference to getting these answers while you're in the field rather than collecting samples, sending them off, and months, and if at all, later you get the answers back, and it's out of context. So here you can see I put the prices up here just to indicate that if you shop around and you don't go to scientific supply houses, but you go to other sources like anywhere from gun dealers to hobbyists to aquarium, these things, the nitrate meter is a bit expensive. I'm afraid Horiba is the only one that produces a decent nitrate meter, and if you don't have any competition, these things are a bit expensive. But drinking water works very well instead of distilled water. In fact, in most countries other than the U.S., the drinking water has a typical analysis on it, so you can avoid some of the waters. A pH meter, you buy this on eBay or Amazon. You can find this Hanna checker it's a very accurate meter, very nice meter, for $30 to $40. And a similar EC meter by Hanna for about $15 to $20. And I want to mention the electrical conductivity. Outside of the usual context of dealing with saline soils, where it has obvious importance, it's also a nice general indicator of the level of fertility, because what is it that's dissolved in the soil solution in a non-saline humid region soil? It's mostly plant nutrients. So this is an example of a couple of soils in Tanzania, a fairly high fertility soil on a research farm, and this one is up on a mountainous terrace, where we're looking at the sum of the measured potassium and nitrate that I measured in the field on repeated samples in these two soils versus the EC. And you can see if you're looking at a limited range here between very low ECs near zero up to maybe as high as one decisiemen per meter, we're talking mostly about nutrients here that either coming from fertilizer or decomposition of organic matter or from ash or something of that nature. So it's an important key to distinguishing the high and low fertility areas in the field. It's also really important to have these in the field with you so that you can look at the water, not just the soil, especially where that water is being used for irrigation. I had some fascinating experiences in the Millennium Village up in just a few weeks ago up in northern Ethiopia, where they had been digging hand wells down to 5, 6, 7, 8 meters. Quite a job, but this is an area of very little water, and they wanted to grow vegetables in the dry season, so they were hand-digging these wells, and initially they were going to bring the water up with buckets, but eventually have some treadle pumps and things. And we looked at, I only had time in the field because these wells were spaced a kilometer apart or so there's a lot of walking involved. I only had time to look at 4 of these wells. They had dug many more. But of the 4, 2 of them had, and they had no information on the water. 2 of them had quite good water, and 2 of them had water with ECs almost 3. you really don't want to use that for irrigation. I mean, you're just asking for trouble unless you have some very specialized methods. I don't know if you can read this one. This is in Senegal, but the EC is 10. No wonder they were having problems when they were using this water. And it varies from well to well because of the stratigraphy. So just knowing which one, they could have tasted that water and figured that out. But they didn't. They had no information on the water. So this is a typical setting. This one is in Rwanda. The farmer and his son, they're farming together. We collected some samples from some of their problem fields. They had fields in which never yielded quite right. It actually was a half of a field. It was the whole field was maybe a third of a hectare or half of a hectare, and part of it yielded much better than the other part continuously, and we talked about that in the field. So we collected some samples and then sat down, and I think you can see the intense interest on the part of the younger guy. He had been to enough schooling that he understood what he had heard of pH, he had heard of these things. He ended up declaring that he wanted to be a soil scientist by the time he left. But we were able to figure out what was going on with these problems. These plates, by the way, are what we collect the soils in. So he brought a little table out, the bench, so that's a little bit comfortable, and we can get some good data. And you actually get pretty decent data if you learn how to use these instruments reasonably well. This is a comparison of some pH is measured in Kenya in the field versus those from the commercial laboratory, and it's virtually the same. I'm not even sure which is better. I didn't bother labeling the axis. It's virtually one-to-one, and I'm not necessarily going to put money on the lab pH. I find if you take care of your electrode, you get the good results. And this expensive nitrate meter, $350, I consider to be an expensive piece of equipment. It's pretty much out of the range. Love to see it come down. But it's also quite accurate. I just got this. This is sort of hot off the press. I just did this. I had one day at my university before I came here, and I ran into the lab and asked my grad students to send them an email. I said, would you lay out some soils that you've analyzed the nitrate on? Because I'm going to come in with my meter, and I want to make a comparison because I hadn't been able to do this. And it's actually quite accurate. On the higher levels, the problem is it breaks down with the low levels. When you're down around 10 or 15 parts per million nitrate, nitrogen in soil, it's not very good at picking those out. But for the higher ones and those high spots in the field, it's quite good. And sometimes we just work in the shade of a tree. That's okay. But you can see the tremendous amount of variability in the background. We were trying to figure out what was wrong with this irrigated maize field in western Tanzania. And sometimes it's raining all the time. This was in Liberia, northern Liberia, and you couldn't really do anything out in the field. You're lucky to find dry enough time to collect samples. So as Pedro would say, I went back to my No Star Hotel and a little plastic table in the evening, ran these samples, and then I was meeting with farmers for the whole week, so we got to go back and give them results. Let me take a little close-up of this, give you an idea of some of the equipment that we're using. Things that are available to us today that weren't available to us 10, 20 years ago. So the old soil test kits with the little color chart that kind of separated out high, medium, low really don't have much value in the context of developing country farmer field where everything's likely to be low. It's a question of low, very low, and really, really low, so nothing will grow. So some of the... this is kind of interesting. This is the equivalent of you just multiply that price by 100. Normally, if you were going to get a balance, the weight to a hundredth of a gram, and you wanted to be accurate, you'd probably spend $1,000, $1,500 on it in the laboratory. This was $15. I've seen them for $12 on eBay. These are sold to jewelers to weigh diamonds and gold. And they're very precise, and they're very good. You can carry it around for months with you and shake it around in this box, and it still works. I calibrated, and I've checked it against others, and I've bought many of these. The little colorimeter was also a find. This was in the swimming pool supply catalog where I found it. You know, you test things in water quality and people that have fish aquaria. It's made by Hanna, which makes scientific products. This one is, you can get it for less than $50 if you shop around, for about $40, $45. It's a pre-programmed for a particular analysis, very repeatable, very accurate. It reads, in this case, phosphate to 0.01 part per million, which is the range you want. And it comes with little, sort of like creamer packs of reagents, so you can do a color test. Now, the expensive part, I have to mention, was the cuvettes. They sold them for $10 a piece. I think that's where they made their money. But it turns out that if you shop around in the science, you can find little culture tubes for about 18 cents a piece that do the same thing, and they have good enough glass so that you get good results. So the point is that there are instruments out there that can give us the kind of results where you can now see the difference between the good and the poor parts of the field. You can get an idea of whether we're in the kind of range with some nutrients and other problems that are really going to cause problems. This gives you just an idea. I just ran these for this paper before I left Tanzania on a couple of soils. This is pH. The brown is pH in water, and then I added a little bit of sodium calcium chloride to get the salt pH for the two soils. And you can see from these box plots that on six samples, you're pretty repeatable, up around 5.5, 5.6 with one, and the other soil is down here around 4.9, almost no variation. And the same thing looking at the nitrate, nitrogen, and the potassium ions in that. In this case, this is the water-soluble, but I can also do the salt-soluble. Very nice distinction between the two soils and pretty repeatable within the replications within the soil. It just occurred to me while I was out with some students from Sokoine University in Tanzania. I'm working with their PhD program in soils there and trying to show them the advantages of being able to actually get some of these numbers in the field, where we have a little beaker. I use these little tiny, they're supposed to be disposable, but I've used them for months and years now, and they hold up very nicely, and they cost almost nothing. This is a one-to-one soil slurry. I'm going to measure the pH on it. But, of course, it's pretty muddy, and it's dispersed. And so to get the sample out to measure some of the nutrients, it's a little bit of a problem. And I was thinking, well, it'd be nice to flocculate that. But I got a little calcium chloride in pellets that is designed for desiccators. You just need a tiny amount of it. You just drop one of these pellets in and stir it, and you immediately get, within a minute or so, a clear solution on the top that you can then pipette off. And we can not only that, but this is giving you something very close to a 0.01, 0.02 molar calcium chloride, which is essentially a salt pH, from which you can calculate the change in pH, which tells you something about the mineralogy and the CEC and exchangeable acidity. And then you can pipette off a little bit of that using a very... must cost less than 2 or 3 cents a piece. They sell them in bags of 500, these little transfer pipettes. If you buy the right ones, they're very accurate because the whole pipette is only 1 mil, so you can very accurately pick off a half a mil. And that's how I get the sample for the analysis. Now, some of these analyses are going to have to bite the bullet and you actually use filter paper. If you're doing if you want to really interpret a phosphorus analysis, you need to have a standard extract mean something. The malic, I think, is a very good one since it's very flexible and works on many soils. So I carry a concentrate with me, which I think can dilute with either rainwater, distilled water, or drinking water. Fortunately, drinking water is usually very low in phosphate. And so I use these little vials and essentially carry out a laboratory procedure, but I can do it in the farmer's field. It just takes a few minutes using that little colorimeter. I also like to use the field version of my active carbon or labile carbon test, which uses a dilute permanganate, potassium permanganate, in these tubes. The light tubes are the ones where the permanganate is reacted with organic matter, so they're higher in organic matter. It's very sensitive. I can remember being, Pedro sent me up to Dirtu. This is on the border of Somali. It's a millennium village in which there are no farmers. These are goat and camel herders, and I couldn't understand why Pedro wanted a soil scientist to go up and look at that. But I ended up finding some interesting things to do. Yeah, I know you've been there too, and found some interesting challenges. And one thing we could see was there was a pattern of land degradation and overgrazing near the water source. And you couldn't actually see this, but you could measure it in the soil. The soils had very measurably and consistently more depleted and less active carbon as you got closer to the water source. We had to go about 7 or 8 kilometers away before we got down to low enough grazing pressures that we got kind of beyond that influence. So this is diagnostic for that type of thing. We also keep our eyes open for biological factors. We do some counts of these things, looking for earthworms and dung beetles and the kind of termite activity and how that interacts with manure and crop residues and all those sorts of things, nodulation and that type of thing. But it's also important to look at the soil profile. Sometimes we want to make measurements, at least in the shallow part of the profile where the root zone is, to look at, say, what is the salt profile, what is the pH profile. So the things we can do, I have a flat tip pH meter, which is from a scientific, they actually have it down in one of the companies, I think, Forest Supply or Gemplers. It's quite nice if you have a wet conditions, like in a rice field or in a rainy season. You just kind of touch it to the, just make contact with the moist soil, you get a pH reading, you can go down a couple centimeters, get another one, and pretty soon you know whether the pH is increasing or decreasing. And you can do the same thing with a direct read EC meter in wet soil. So it does have to be wet soil to use this, but you just poke this in, get a reading, and you can see whether the salts are rising or not. So sometimes it's very diagnostic. And you want to carry some little dropper bottles of some of the magic drops. Of course, everybody knows about the 10% HCl if you're looking to see if there are carbonates there. But you might also want to be looking for, especially in rice fields or in wet areas, to see if there's reduced iron. So carry a little bit of alpha dipyridyl with you. And if you can get 10% H2O2, don't label it as peroxide. That word peroxide equates to rocket fuel and explosives, and the TSA does not like it. So just call it bleach, and you'll probably be okay. But it will react with manganese, so if you're wondering whether that black is organic matter or manganese, it'll help you with that. And then there's some physical things that you might want to do in the profile to detect plow pans and that type of thing. So a little penetrometer, a little hand penetrometer is nice. And also cheap. Now, this is a little pricey again. I probably shouldn't include this. You can just feel the soil. And handing the soil to a farmer and having him feel it is usually convincing, but this is a capacitance meter so that you can see what the moisture is like in the profile. Quick example of how this might work. This was in Liberia last December. I was working with a number of farmers of ACDI Volca. I just went over as a volunteer. And we were doing farmer training for vegetable growers, and these two brothers had what for the area was a pretty large and successful bitterball farm. This is a kind of West African eggplant kind of vegetable. But there were parts of this farm, probably 30% of his farm or so, that was probably giving him zero profit. I mean, that his returns was costing him more than he was getting out of it, and this is what I'm calling the poor areas. And then there were other areas where the plants were much more vigorous and the ground was covered and the yields were much higher, and that's where he was making his money. So we started investigating the soil profile. I've got a nice shovel in Monrovia. It's kind of my first purchase when I get out of the airport, is to get a good shovel. And if we looked at this profile, this is basically what we saw. We didn't have to go very deep to see this difference. And the poor areas, it had a similar kind of, this is in a rainforest area with shifting cultivation, so you had a little organic layer. The real problem came in here with this laterite or hardened plinthite gravel. Where that was near the surface, nothing would grow very well. That was really a limitation. And those were areas that I think there's nothing practical that he could do about it except avoid it and plant some other kinds of plants there. And it would be much more profitable for him to concentrate on the good areas. Those were not there in the others. And then, of course, we don't want to forget about the plants. We can't just look at the soils. If you can possibly get out while the plants are growing, the plants will tell you a lot. Another use for the good shovel is to dig up the root systems and have a look at the below ground as well as the above ground parts of the plants. And again, some of the gadgets help, too. This was a great a great example. You saw this all over near the village of Deborah Bahan. This is a village of about 5,000 farmers, part of the Millennium Cluster up in Tigray. Short rainy season, they're growing finger millet, and they have a lot of these rather small-looking, I didn't even recognize them as being Fihertia albida. And it looks like a shadow under the tree, but it's not. You walk out on that shadow, and the shadow is chest-high finger millet, dark green. You walk away from it, and the finger millet's only knee-high. So I sent the boy out to get some, and we collected about a dozen plants from the shadow and about a dozen plants from around the lighter green areas. And then we pulled out a table and I thought this was a discovery of mine. I thought it was really clever of me to think of using a garlic press, but apparently everybody does that. I just didn't know about it. But if you want to squeeze a little bit of sap out of a finger millet stem or a rice stem, it takes a lot of leverage. It's not an easy thing to do, but a good garlic press, buy the best one you can, will really do the job. You just chop it up, put them in there, and it's designed to do that. And then these little meters come in handy. They really can be worth their weight in gold. This is the little phosphate meter, and this is the potassium meter by Horiba, and the nitrate meter, and all you need is a drop or two. You just squeeze it out, and then you can get a reading. I decided to extend that for sulfur because one of my pet peeves is that nobody analyzes sulfur. You'll notice that you'll find people that analyze 15 elements and sulfur will be missing somehow. And sulfur is widely deficient, especially in Africa. And so you can take a drop of that sap and dilute it about 20 times with drinking water, as long as it's not a high sulfate drinking water, and just put a couple of crystals of barium chloride in that, and you can get a nice, I think even under this bad lighting, you can see the difference between this cloudiness and that cloudiness, but the meter is very good at doing it. So I use the phosphate meter. It doesn't matter what the wavelength is. It doesn't matter that it's reading in parts per million phosphate. I just make a standard curve using I carry a little standard solution of sulfate. And from that, you could see that the millet under the tree had about four times as much sulfate, sulfur in the sap. In fact, this was very diagnostic. We put it together. Why was that millet growing so much better under the tree? What was the tree doing for it? And it wasn't potassium for sure. There's plenty of potassium in both cases in the sap. This is the concentration in the sap. It wasn't phosphorus. The farmers were using some DAP. It was part of the project to supply that. In fact, it was lower in the good millet because it was diluted in the big plants. But it was pretty clearly a question of sulfur and nitrogen, which were being fixed and recycled by the tree, which fit in really nicely with what I had studied a couple of decades earlier with this similar kind of system in Malawi, where we also found sulfur and nitrogen to be the big issues. So that's just an example of how you can use this on-the-spot information. So while you're in the field, to start discussing, well, what can we do to try to alleviate these situations and manage for them. So thanks very much for your attention. These are some of my helpers in the field.